From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Perhaps the most controversial group within the Catholic Church is Opus Dei. Its core ideal is the sanctification of work. The group was created in 1928. The founder was canonized by Pope John Paul. But critics and some former members have accused the group of cult-like practices and promoting a right-wing agenda. The group is portrayed as villainous in the best-selling murder mystery novel, The Da Vinci Code. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with John Allen about his new book, Opus Dei. It tries to separate the facts from the myths. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Woman at the Washington Zoo, writings on politics, family, and fate. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Baby by the Detroit Cobras. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In its short history, Opus Dei has become perhaps the most controversial group within the Catholic Church. The basic principle behind Opus Dei is the sanctification of work, but critics describe it as a secretive and cult-like group whose real aims are the acquisition of political power, promoting a right-wing agenda, and financial gain. Opus Dei was portrayed as villainous in The Da Vinci Code, the best-selling murder mystery novel about secret religious societies. Opus Dei was founded in Spain in 1928 by José María Escrivá. Now a saint, he was canonized by Pope John Paul in 2002. My guest John Allen has written a new book called Opus Dei that tries to separate the myths from the reality. Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a Vatican analyst for CNN and is the author of several books about the Vatican. Let's start with how members of Opus Dei define Opus Dei. Would you describe the role of work in Opus Dei?
Well, Terry, this is one of those points where perceptions of Opus Dei from the outside and from the inside tend to differ dramatically. From the outside, Opus Dei often looks like a conservative organization intended to advance a particular agenda either inside the Catholic Church or in the sphere of secular politics. From the inside, however, Opus Dei is much more a private spiritual path, the heart of which is the idea of the sanctification of work. That is, whatever your work is, whether it's being a stay-at-home mom, being a barber, being a bus driver, being the CEO of General Motors, or hosting a famous National Public Radio radio program, that is where God has called you to be, and those are the moments in which you are called to do three things. One is to sanctify yourself, that is, make yourself holy by taking this work seriously, trying to do your very best. Sanctify others by taking an interest in them, not just as automatons or not just as colleagues, but as human beings. And sanctify the world by using this work as a way to bring a kind of holiness and a sense of reverence and so on to the highways and byways of the secular world. In the members of Opus Dei would see themselves as remarkably free in how they go about it. That is, there's no corporate plan for that. What they get from Opus Dei is a kind of spiritual and doctrinal formation, and then they're sort of turned loose on the world.
As you point out in your group, some people might think that Opus Dei it sounds like a traditional group in some ways, but it's really not traditional because it redefines lay life. What is different about Opus Dei's view of the laity?
Well, I mean, there's a sense in which I think it's probably fair to call Opus Dei traditional in the sense that in the kind of culture wars inside Roman Catholicism since the Second Vatican Council, that is the mid-1960s, when the Church embarked on this reforming, modernizing, liberalizing path, I mean, Opus Dei certainly would represent a more traditional alternative to the kind of progressive wing of the Church in that time. But if you take a broader historic view and go back to the Church of the late 1920s, 1930s, when Opus Dei was born, it really was quite a revolution, because the idea at the heart of Opus Dei is that you would have men and women, clergy and laity, all sharing the same vocation, all fully equal inside this organization, and all under one kind of administrative and legal roof. And this was something that had never happened in Roman Catholicism before. It was always believed that if lay people were going to be part of some organization, they had to do so in a kind of derivative way, taking direction from clergy. And certainly in Spain in the late 20s and 30s, the idea was that if a layperson was going to act as a Catholic in law or in medicine or in politics, that that layperson certainly needed to be taking very clear direction from someone wearing a Roman collar. And Opus Dei sort of set that on its head, so much so that in 30s and 40s Spain, there were actually accusations of heresy directed against Opus Dei and its founder, and they were at one stage denounced to the Vatican as a kind of liberal avant-garde in Roman Catholicism.
There's several different groups of people, several different levels of belonging, so to speak, within Opus Dei. Can you give us brief descriptions of what each of them are?
Sure. The basic distinction between the lay members of Opus Dei, which is about 90% of the organization, would be between the supernumeraries and the numeraries. These are terms that come out of Spanish academic life in the early 20th century. Basically speaking, the supernumeraries, or about 70% of the members, would be married lay people who live out in the world, who have jobs, who have families, and from any kind of external point of view are completely indistinguishable from the rest of the world. They do not make promises of celibacy or of poverty or so on. Then you have the roughly 20% of members who are numeraries. These are lay people who live full-time, that is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in Opus Dei centers. Some of them will have outside jobs, some of them don't, but they are 100% available, so to speak, to the work of Opus Dei. They do make promises of celibacy, and they also make promises, not quite of poverty, but to turn over whatever they don't need of their personal earnings to some of the corporate works of Opus Dei, such as their schools and their social service centers and so on. Then, of course, there are the 10% who are priests, who live a life that basically is quite similar to the numeraries.
There's also a group, I think they're called auxiliaries, a group of women who dedicate themselves to cooking and cleaning Opus Dei facilities.
Right. These are a subset of the numeraries. And there, you're quite right, Terry. There are about 4,000 women, and they are exclusively women inside Opus Dei, whose full-time work is what they call the domestic care of Opus Dei centers. And practically that means, in some cases, it means the financial management of large centers, but it also often means, very concretely, the cooking, the cleaning, you know, the laundry, making beds, and so on. Now, it should be said that this is not simply a case of the women cleaning up after the men, because women do the same thing for women's centers. But yet, it is a kind of striking thing in the early 21st century that you have an institution, a kind of subclass of members within an institution, whose task is to cook and clean that is restricted entirely to women.
And what is the thinking behind that?
Well, I suppose there are two points that are typically made when you talk, and I interviewed several of this particular kind of numerae as I moved around the world. And what I found is that first thing they will tell you is that for them this is analogous to being a mother. That is, that they feel like they're acting as a mother of the particular family where they live. That is, the Opus Dei center or the residence or what have you. And so they see it as analogous to being a stay-at-home mom. Secondly, if you press them as to why it has to be women, the answer that typically is given is that women simply have a kind of special genius for domestic care, for nurture, and so on, that in most cases men lack. And that is a kind of, you know, traditionalist conception of things in some ways that that is awfully countercultural in the world in which we live, but it is what they say. And then finally, if you really press beyond that, what they'll tell you is that this was the vision of Saint José María Escrivá, that is, the founder of Opus Dei. And in my experience, when you're talking with Opus Dei members about various issues in terms of the internal life of Opus Dei, this is sort of where argument ends, that they are often quite willing, surprisingly willing, to be flexible and open about many points. But if you rub up against something that was part of the specific vision of the founder, Escrivá, then that usually is where argument stops.
But this leads to a larger gender issue within Opus Dei. There's strict gender segregation for the people who live in Opus Dei facilities. Obviously, if you live with your family, then you can live with your spouse and be with your children. But for everyone else, you know, for the people who live in Opus Dei facilities, strict gender separation. What is the logic behind that?
There is a kind of rigid segregation. Now, we're talking again among the numerary members. That's about 20% of the members. A rigid segregation between men and women. And I'll give you one classic example. When I went to the New York headquarters of Opus Dei at 34th and Lex in Manhattan to interview the woman who is the American head of Opus Dei, I was, it's one building, but they have separate men's and women's quarters. And so the male numerary who was walking me over to my appointment actually had to walk me out of the building and around the block to come back in through another door. And then told me he was very excited to have this opportunity because although he and this woman had lived in the same building for 3 years, he'd never met her. And this is actually not at all uncommon. And it does, again, I say, for a kind of, you know, modern Western 21st century take on things, this seems very odd. Now, there is both a historical logic, which is that in the history of the Catholic Church, the idea of having men and women as members of one organic body under the same leadership simply didn't exist before. You may have male Dominicans and female Dominicans, but they're completely separate under separate leadership and have nothing to do with one another. And the concern always was that if you had men and women in the same organization rubbing shoulders, that might lead to what was called in the old days promiscuity. And so Jose Maria Escrivá's answer to that was to raise a wall of separation between men and women so high inside Opus Dei that promiscuity would seem laughable. And in so doing, he probably saved his original vision of Opus Dei as this one organic body unified between men and women and clergy and lay people. I suppose the other practical reality, if you ask women inside Opus Dei about this separation, they will tell you that it gives them a kind of autonomy, that is, that they are completely separate from the men's branch. They run their own affairs, they manage their own resources, they make their own decisions, and never have the sensation that a man is looking over the shoulder, secretly calling the shots. And so in that sense, they will tell you that the separation is experienced by them as a kind of freedom.
Do the men and women's groups have equal powers within the larger organization?
Well, yes and no. There are governing bodies for both the men and the women who have the same powers over the men and women's branches. However, ultimately, Opus Dei is what's called a personal prelature in the Catholic Church, which means it is governed over by a prelate who is usually a bishop. In the current case, it's Bishop Echevarria, Javier Echevarria, who is the personal secretary of Escrivá, which means that ultimately, at the end of the day, when you get down to where does the buck stop, the buck stops on the desk of the bishop, who is by definition a man. However, I mean, one should hasten to add that that doesn't make Opus Dei any different than the rest of the Catholic Church.
My guest is John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book is called Opus Dei. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Allen. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and author of the new book, Opus Dei. Now, another thing that makes Opus Dei controversial is the practice of mortification, self-mortification, which I'm going to ask you to describe how it's done within Opus Dei.
Well, if you wanted to be sort of flippant about it, you would say it's a matter of whips and chains. That is to say, there are two practices of so-called corporal mortification, that is, inflicting pain on oneself, that a minority of members of Opus Dei, again, it's just the numeraries and the priests, so about 30% of the members, practice. The first is called the cilice. This is a spiked chain that is worn around the thigh for 2 hours a day, except for Sundays. Sundays are considered a kind of mini feast day. And then there is a small cloth whip called the discipline that one administers to oneself once a week, usually on Saturday, during the recitation of a prayer, like the Lord's Prayer or the Hail Mary. So in other words, it's a very quick thing that might endure a matter of a few minutes once a week. Now, when you ask Opus Dei people why do these things, they will tell you, first of all, that it's hardly just Opus Dei that does them. Many of the great saints in the history of the Church, from St. Francis all the way up to Mother Teresa, have used the discipline. They'll also tell you that it's about reminding oneself of the consequences of sin, identifying with the suffering of Christ and the suffering of the world. They will tell you that these are very mild practices that are constantly scrutinized to make sure that they don't get out of hand. Now, if you ask critical ex-members of Opus Dei, they will tell you that sometimes they have, in fact, gotten out of hand, that sometimes they have been pushed too far. If you ask most spiritual directors in the Catholic Church outside of Opus Dei, that is, moderate mainstream people, they will tell you that they find the practice of corporal mortification at best strange and at worst possibly counterproductive, because if you really want to enter into the suffering of the world, you don't necessarily need to whip yourself. You could go serve at a soup kitchen or you could work at a homeless shelter and so on. So I would say this is a practice for which Opus Dei has some warrant, but it's certainly something that is widely debated in Catholic circles.
Critics of Opus Dei and some ex-members of Opus Dei have compared it to a cult group. What are the comparisons?
First of all, let me say that if you talk to academic experts on new religious movements, they will tell you that, cult is really a word that often functions for a religious phenomenon that someone doesn't like. That is, it's very difficult to define exactly what is meant by a cult. But I suppose in the street sense of cult, people think of mind control, excessive control over members, a kind of blind, unthinking obedience that is expected, and so on. And this is, again, one of those cases where I think there perhaps is some reality to these perceptions, although that reality is experienced very differently depending on who you talk to. Let's talk about the facts. First of all, it is a fact that for numerary members of Opus Dei, again, that's that 20% of lay people who live in Opus Dei centers, they are expected to consult with other members of Opus Dei before reading certain kinds of books. They are expected to disclose details of their personal lives in spiritual direction with other members. They live in close quarters with one another, and there is a just kind of oversight, if you like, or a sacrifice of privacy and of control over one's time and space that is just part and parcel of that experience. Now, if you talk to most Opus Dei members about that and you ask them how do they experience it, they will tell you they find it incredibly liberating, they find it life-giving, they find it joyful, that they feel like they have given their lives over to a very noble purpose, which is serving Christ, serving the church, serving humanity, and that these demands that are placed upon them help them live the kind of life they want to live. Now, if you ask critical ex-members who have gone through the very same experiences, they will often tell you that they found it invasive, they found it demeaning, they found it overly controlling, and in some ways they found it an unhuman set of expectations that in the end kind of crushed them and ground them down. I think this is one of those cases where it's almost impossible to believe that one side is lying and the other is telling the truth. I think both are accurately describing their own reactions to a kind of common set of experiences.
Does Opus Dei try to restrict the books or the music or the TV shows, movies that its members are allowed to see?
Well, you have to very quickly distinguish between the supernumeraries who are married, living out in the world in their own homes, and who are effectively beyond anyone's control, and the numeraries who are living in Opus Dei centers and who therefore can be monitored, so to speak, much more closely. In the case of the numeraries, yes, there is an expectation that before they read certain kinds of books, certainly any books on the faith or morals of the Catholic Church, they would consult an Opus Dei database about books to see what other members have said about it and perhaps be warned off of it. There is an expectation among numeraries that they're not going to go to movies, they're not going to go to sporting events, and for the most part, they don't watch much television except the occasional news program or documentary. And this is, in effect, to protect them, so to speak, from unwanted outside influences that might distract them from their spiritual path. If you talk to current members, they will tell you that that all those controls have freed them up to live the kind of life, to make the kind of choices, to become the kind of people that they believe God wants them to become, and therefore they experienced it as a very positive rather than a very controlling thing.
Opus Dei is not officially a political group, but do you think it's fair to say that the majority of the members of Opus Dei are very conservative in their political positions?
Yes, I do. And I think you make exactly the right distinction. I mean, it was an article of faith for José María Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei, that corporately speaking, Opus Dei would never have a political line, that those conclusions would be left to the freedom of its members. And so officially speaking, they don't have any positions on tax policy or social policy or whatever. But certainly informally, if you look at the sociology of the kind of person who becomes an Opus Dei member, I think it's quite fair to say that both on church matters and also on secular political matters, the center of gravity overwhelmingly would be on the right.
And how active is Opus Dei on the political right?
Well, I don't think Opus Dei as such is active, but certainly there are some Opus Dei members who are quite active. One thinks, for example, of England, where the education minister, Ruth Kelly, therefore one of the top officials of the Blair government, is an Opus Dei supernumerary. One thinks of Peru, where the leader of one of the strongest opposition parties in the parliament, a guy by the name of Rafael Rey, is a numerary. And there are other examples in other parts of the world. So there certainly are some individual Opus Dei members who are quite engaged in politics. For the most part, they would be part of right-leaning parties. You know, what makes Ruth Kelly such an interesting phenomenon in England, of course, is that she's part of Blair's Labour Party, and therefore, you know, in a big picture sense, sort of center-left. Most Opus Dei members involved in politics would be on the other side of the street.
What about in the United States? Who are some of the prominent figures here who are members of Opus Dei?
Well, to tell you the truth, there aren't that many. I think it's easier to talk about people who have been linked to Opus Dei who are not. You know, for example, Justices Scalia and Thomas on the United States Supreme Court have sometimes been rumored to be Opus Dei members. In the course of work for the book, you know, both of them through aides indicated that they were not Opus Dei members. The political columnist and TV pundit Robert Novak has sometimes been linked to Opus Dei. He is, in fact, not a member, directly denied it to me. Senator Sam Brownback, who is a recent convert to the Catholic Church and was assisted in that process by an Opus Dei priest, has sometimes been assumed, therefore, to be a member of Opus Dei. He isn't. So, frankly, the list of politically active Opus Dei members in the United States is a very short one, and frankly, at the national level, in terms of names people would have heard of, I'm not sure that they have anyone.
John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book is called Opus Dei. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anthony Trollope's satire of money madness, The Way We Live Now, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. Additional support comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Retirement for Two, Everything You Need to Know to Thrive Together as Long as You Both Shall Live, by Marianne Vanderveld. And from Warner Home Video, presenting March of the Penguins DVD, a family film about the journey that emperor penguins take in order to become parents. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the relationship between the Vatican and Opus Dei. We continue our conversation with John Allen. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a collection of writings on politics, family, and fate by the late Marjorie Williams, and Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the Detroit Cobras. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book, Opus Dei, tries to separate the facts from the myths surrounding this controversial Catholic group. The group Opus Dei was founded on the ideal of the sanctification of work, but critics maintain that Opus Dei is cult-like and has a right-wing political agenda. When we left off, Allen was saying that although Opus Dei is not a political group, its members tend to be conservative in their political positions, and some of them are politically engaged. In speaking of the political influence of Opus Dei, I'd like to ask you about the Catholic Information Center on K Street in Washington, D.C. And this is a group that's active in lobbying for, I believe, anyways, that it's active in lobbying for conservative causes. And it's located in the heart of American political lobbying. And although it's not an Opus Dei organization, it has been run for several years by members of Opus Dei. And in fact, it was one of those leaders of this group who's a member of Opus Dei who I think brought Congressman Sam Brownback in either into Catholicism or into a more conservative form of Catholicism, and also Robert Novak, the political columnist.
Yeah, well, the Catholic Information Center, at the heart of it, is a bookstore, which is run by Opus Dei priests. At one stage, it was run by a priest by the name of Father John McCloskey, who is probably the most prominent Opus Dei member in the United States. It was Father McCloskey who was involved in bringing Senator Brown back and bringing Mr. Novak and others into the Catholic Church, though not into Opus Dei. I would say the Catholic Information Center isn't so much a lobby as it is a crossroads for conservative Catholic political operatives of all sorts. I mean, if you go into the noontime mass there, you will meet conservative Catholic legislators, you will meet conservative Catholic lobbyists, people who work at think tanks, you know, policy analysts, and so on. It's a place where, in a sense, they network. And in that sense, I think Opus Dei more broadly and in microcosm form in this particular place, the Catholic Information Center on K Street, provides, in a sense, a kind of space in which conservative Catholic political activists and thinkers meet and greet.
Let me ask you about the relationship between the Catholic Church and Opus Dei. Pope John Paul canonized the founder of Opus Dei, who is now a saint. The relationship was not always that close. When the religion was founded, the relationship was not close between Opus Dei and the larger church, was it?
Well, I think every new reality in the Catholic Church, you know, often runs into the slings and arrows of opposition, and certainly that was true of Opus Dei. It was born in Spain in 1928, and as it grew up, it quickly became the principal rival, so to speak, of the Jesuit order. That's the older established Jesuit community, religious order, for vocations among young Spanish men. And so there was a tremendous kind of back-and-forth rivalry, very bitter at times, between the Jesuits and Opus Dei that in some ways has lasted in some parts of the world to the present day. And so in that sense, I mean, Opus Dei has certainly had its, you know, its ups and downs in terms of reception in the broader Catholic world. But I think in many ways, all of that came to an end under John Paul II, in the sense that if there were any doubt that Opus Dei had the official approval of the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church, that certainly was resolved under John Paul. He created Opus Dei as a personal prelature, giving them a very special status under church law that no one else enjoys in 1982. He beatified José María Escrivá, the founder, in 1992, and then canonized him in 2002. In other words, there was a major gesture of papal support and favor at a rhythm of once every 10 years under John Paul II. No other organization could point to that kind of clear public endorsement.
Do you know why the Pope was such a supporter of Opus Dei?
Yes. John Paul actually had never met either José María Escrivá or Opus Dei in Poland. Actually, Opus Dei didn't arrive in Poland until well after John Paul was elected Pope. But he had been reading Escrivá, reading his works, for some time. You have to understand that Cardinal Carol Wojtyla, the man who became John Paul II, came out of the matrix of the Solidarity experience in Poland, and probably his number one theological concern was coming up with a Christian spirituality of work that would, in a sense, counter the Marxist reading of work. That is, that work is an alienating reality that is imposed upon the working class by the rulers. Wojtyla, John Paul II, wanted to come up with a theological reading of work that would be much more positive, that would actually see work as a kind of participation in the ongoing creation of the world. And he found in José María Escrivá someone who was thinking along the same lines, someone for whom the sanctification of work and the spirituality of work was at the heart of his own reflections. And so there was always a kind of sense of kindred spirit, I think, between Jean-Paul II and Escrivá. The day before the conclave, that is the event that elects the new pope, the first one in 1978 that elected Jean-Paul I, Cardinal Wojtyla, his last stop before heading into the conclave to vote for the next pope, was to pray at the tomb of Escrivá at the Roman headquarters of Opus Dei in Villa Tevere. So I think there was a clear personal biographical affection and connection, if you like, between that pope and this movement that explains why he favored it at every turn.
Is Pope Benedict XVI sympathetic to Opus Dei?
Well, I think Benedict XVI supports Opus Dei, but I don't think he has anything like the deep personal connection to it that Jean-Paul II did. Benedict's heart is very much with another new movement in the 20th century history of the Catholic Church called Communion and Liberation. So while I think Pope Benedict will continue to support and endorse the activities of Opus Dei, Opus Dei will not have the direct pipeline to the papacy that at hand under Jean-Paul II. I think some observers think that that might be all for the good, that part of the reason Opus Dei was so controversial in the Catholic Church over the last 26 years was that for people who had a kind of negative judgment of the Pope, that pretty automatically became a negative judgment of Opus Dei and vice versa. If there's some distance between Opus Dei and the Pope, as there certainly will be under this pontificate, then perhaps people can make evaluations that are more directly focused on Opus Dei in and of itself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Allen. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and author of several books. His latest is called Opus Dei. Some people who have tried to write about Opus Dei have complained that the organization is so secretive. It's hard to really get to the bottom of things. Did you find it to be secretive, and were there obstacles that you faced in trying to paint a full picture of Opus Dei?
Well, you know, I had insisted on getting a pledge of complete cooperation from Opus Dei before I began this project. And I would say that, you know, for the most part, they held up their end of the deal. The problem with Opus Dei often isn't so much that it's secretive. It's that it has its own way of seeing itself that is just very foreign and makes getting even basic information quite difficult. For example, Opus Dei would take the position that all of their schools and their hospitals and their social service centers are locally run enterprises that are administered by lay people in complete freedom, for which Opus Dei Incorporated, you know, has no responsibility. So that if you go to Opus Dei in the United States and you say, I would like a consolidated financial statement for all of the Opus Dei schools and hospices and so on in the States, it simply doesn't exist. Opus Dei doesn't collect that information. And the same thing is true at the international level. So to get a financial profile of Opus Dei in the States, I and my financial expert had to run around and collect the 990 forms of every separately incorporated nonprofit organization in the country that had some kind of link to Opus Dei. We had to jump through the same hoops worldwide. Or on the question of membership, often in the course of public conversation about prominent people, the question will arise, is he or she a member of Opus Dei? Opus Dei has the position that when it comes to its supernumerary members, that's the 70% of members who are married, living out in the world with their own families and so on, that it's a private choice whether or not that person wants to reveal their membership, which means that you can never get this information from the organization. You actually have to go member by member, asking the question one person by one person, and it can be an extraordinarily time-consuming process. So, you know, if you ask me, are there times when I felt I wasn't getting information I wanted? Yeah, that happened actually with some frequency, but I don't think it's because they were trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I think it's because they're trying to live a life based on a set of premises that is just very, very different from how a corporation or a kind of NGO, a typical NGO in the West would organize itself. And given those different points of departure, it can sometimes be difficult to figure out what's going on.
What did you learn about the finances of Opus Dei?
Oh, simply that there's a lot less there than most people imagine. I mean, Opus Dei's total assets in the United States, that is the value of all of its buildings, all of its real estate, pens and pencils, everything it owns, is about $340 million. Now, by way of comparison, a major urban archdiocese in the United States would have assets that are well over $1 billion. Or to take another comparison, the Knights of Columbus, which is a lay Catholic organization, predominantly American, has an insurance program that all by itself is worth more than $6 billion. So by those points of comparison, Opus Dei is simply not the kind of mammoth financial octopus that some people imagined. The most liberal estimate of its worldwide assets is about $2.8 billion, which again is much less than the assets of even mid-sized nonprofit groups, foundations in the United States and elsewhere. So while those give it some resources, it simply does not have the massive bags of cash that some people have imagined.
What is the money used for?
Largely to operate what are called Opus Dei's corporate works. It runs a network of schools, that is K-12 in some cases schools, and universities. It has a series of hospices and hospitals. It has a series of social service centers. For example, there's something called the Metro Center in Chicago that works with poor African-American and Hispanic youth in an after-school tutoring and sports program, trying to keep them out of gangs and give them an advantage in terms of eventual college admissions. And so the vast majority of Opus Dei's resources are plowed back into running those activities. In addition to the centers of Opus Dei, those are the residences where the numeraries live all around the world, which is kind of the basic building block of Opus Dei.
What reaction have you gotten to your book from members of Opus Dei?
Well, I think there is a kind of split inside Opus Dei with regard to the book. I think some members have told me that they very much appreciate what they see as a kind of balanced attempt to be fair in the book, and some have actually said they've learned from seeing an outsider trying to describe their life and their mentality and so on. I think other members of Opus Dei have a hard time seeing some of these controversies we've been talking about today, the money, the women, the power, and so on. They feel they've been through that so many times that it's a bit like somebody just, you know, ripping open a wound that hasn't yet healed, and therefore would see the book as perhaps being a bit too sensationalistic and a bit too focused on what they would see as problems as opposed to strengths. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, one person's balance is another person's excess in one direction or another. I think you see that reflected also in attitudes of members of Opus Dei about this project.
John Allen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book is called Opus Dei. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the Detroit Cobras, a group known for their wild versions of other people's songs. This is Fresh Air. The Detroit Cobras are, as their name says, based in Detroit and specialize in raucous covers of other people's songs. Reviews of the group, who've now put out three CDs, often emphasize their raunchy bad girl image, courtesy of lead singer Rachel Nagy and guitarist Mary Ramirez. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their new album Baby and some thoughts on the pros and cons of not writing your own material.
I wanna hear you say yeah.
For as long as rock and roll has existed, white rockers have been covering black rhythm and blues songs. But as rock has evolved, it became not merely a point of pride, but a proof of talent for rock musicians to compose their own material. The Detroit Cobras, however, reject this notion. Instead, rummaging through the pop, soul, R&B canon, and unearthing slightly obscure, rich songs, road testing them in front of audiences by constant touring, and then getting their interpretations down in the studio with as much of their live energy as is possible. It's a romantic, slipping around, yeah. That's the Detroit Cobras version of the Dan Penn Spooner Oldham song, Slippin' Around. Penn and Oldham are the authors of better-known hits like James and Bobby Purify's I'm Your Puppet and the Box Tops' Cry Like a Baby. One thing I like about the Cobras is that they don't pick obscure oldies just for the sake of proving their coolness or their scholarship. They pick sturdy should-have-been hits, like that one, or this one, a rouser by no less than Isaac Hayes, Steve Cropper, and David Porter, and originally recorded in 1966 by Ruby Johnson called Weak Spot. When a vocalist like Nagy roars through a song, clichés like whiskey-soaked or allusions to smoky cigarettes tend to crop up in reviews. There's the implication that Rachel Nagy is pushing a loose woman persona when she sings about raunchy sex, as though this was something novel. All of which just gets in the way of appreciating the Cobras' meticulous musicianship. It takes a lot of skill to make songs sound so tossed off, and yet as stirring as most of this album can be. Then again, the one original tune on the album is their sloppiest, a genially silly double entendre joke called Hot Dog, Watch Me Eat.
Come on, baby, I got no time to waste. Come on, baby, you're gonna like it once you get a taste. I got a feeling in my heart.
During the heyday of punk rock in the 70s, there was a parallel movement, a revival of white R&B and rockabilly bands who sped up the tempo of the oldies that they covered. In L.A., where I lived at the time, I knew that Billy Zoom, the guitarist for that town's best punk band, X, had been recruited from a rockabilly band. And another group, the Blasters, switched easily between the two forms. In a similar way now, the Detroit Cobras infuse old music with fresh energy, making the very term oldie irrelevant. This is music that exists in an eternal present, living and vital, ageless.
It's raining so hard. Look like it's gonna rain all night. And this is a time I'd love to be holding you tight. But I guess I'll have to accept the fact that you're not here. I wish the night would hurry up and end, my dear. It's raining so hard. It's really coming down. Sitting by my window, watching the rain fall to the ground. This is the time I'd love to be holding you tight. I guess I'll just go crazy tonight. It's raining so hard.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Baby by the Detroit Cobras. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a collection of writings on family, politics, and fate by the journalist Marjorie Williams, who died of liver cancer earlier this year. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Marjorie Williams was a Washington journalist who wrote profiles for Vanity Fair, a weekly column for the Washington Post's op-ed page, and book reviews for the online magazine Slate. In 2001, Williams, who was to all appearances in terrific health, was diagnosed with advanced liver cancer. Against the odds, she survived 3.5 more years. She died this past January at the age of 47. Williams' husband, Timothy Noah, who was a senior writer at Slate, has put together a collection of her writings, some pieces published for the first time in this collection. The collection is called The Woman at the Washington Zoo. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
There's a great Laurie Moore short story about a dancer who's ill. I've forgotten the title of the story, but there's one line in it I've always remembered. It reads, "Dance is life, giving death the finger." That line began running through my head after I read the first few pieces by Marjorie Williams, collected in The Woman at the Washington Zoo. Williams' sentences dance. They're acrobatic, graceful, and sassy. Her sentences, so full of vitality, give death the finger, even as, in the final section of this collection, they also give death its due. You don't have to have been aware of Marjorie Williams' work before her most untimely death this year to be utterly absorbed by the pieces in The Woman at the Washington Zoo. As a reading experience, it's a call not to respectful tribute, but to pleasure and enlightenment. Williams' husband and the editor of this collection, Timothy Noah, opens it with a selection of the brilliant political profiles Williams wrote for The Washington Post and Vanity Fair during the Bush 1 and Clinton administrations. Reading them is like reacquainting yourself with a once-familiar rogues gallery of Washington insiders like Vernon Jordan and Richard Darman, characters who still fascinate because their personalities are so outsized. Williams' profile of Barbara Bush is particularly sharp, considering, as it does, the noted schism between the former First Lady's public image, now somewhat eroded, as a helpmate, and the titanic force of her caustic private self. I don't think I've ever heard anyone else besides Williams propose class in addition to the social pressure to conform to a traditional wifely role as the key to Barbara Bush's discordant behavior. Williams says, "The only way to reconcile the two facets of Barbara Bush is to understand her as a woman of her class, the American social stratum that has always raised its children to assume their own superiority, and also to mask that assumption at all times." So smart. In the personal essays that begin to infiltrate this collection halfway through, Williams trains that same acuity on her own reluctance to marry, her son's fearful fascination with bugs, and, in a long shape-shifting piece called The Alchemist, on her mother. Timothy Noah discovered that piece after his wife's death and speculates that she felt it too raw to be published during her own lifetime. In The Alchemist, Williams recalls growing up in a family of five, presided over by her bon vivant father, who was a fixture in the New York publishing world, and her emotionally reticent mother, a gourmet cook who preferred to stay in the shadows during the literary dinner parties the couple hosted. Williams observes of her mother that cooking, which others praised as her glory, seemed to me her bunker. Sometime during my adolescence, the mother I loved had vanished into the faultless form of giving that ruled her orderly kitchen. You could eat at her table every night and never once taste the thing that you were really hungry for. The third section of this book is composed of Williams' writings about her battle, her inexplicable, absurd, and terrifying battle with liver cancer. The lead-off piece, Hit by Lightning, a Cancer Memoir, appears in print here for the first time. It's not that these personal essays transcend the journalistic techniques that informed the earlier sections of this book. Rather, it's their journalistic attention to detail, to the telling remark, wedded to an overarching awareness of her own death sentence that graced them with such power. Williams writes of chatting on the phone one day, her hand idly roaming on her stomach, and coming upon a lump the size of a small apricot in her lower abdomen. An ultrasound later locates at least 5 large tumors that had metastasized from her liver, the very same day that a clueless au pair is arriving from the Czech Republic to help tend her young children, then 5 and 8. There's much anger in these essays directed at stupid doctors and New Age idiots who arrogantly lecture her on the psychological toxins she surely must have harbored to thus bring this cancer upon herself. And there is grief at leaving a family, a life she obviously loves. The final, very short essay in the collection is called The Halloween of My Dreams, and in it, Williams writes of watching her almost 9-year-old daughter go out the door for a night of trick-or-treating. Adorned in glitter and makeup, she looks fleetingly like a teenager. Williams savors that vision of the future beyond her own death, and her words dance.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed The Woman at the Washington Zoo, Writings on Politics, Family, and Fate by Marjorie Williams. Timothy Noah edited his late wife's collection. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from WorkSong, Rhino and Starbucks presenting I Believe to My Soul, a CD featuring 5 soul artists. Information at starbucks.com/hearmusic. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It won't be long yet.
On the next Fresh Air, a new biography of the Beatles. We talk to the author, Bob Spitz. And we talk with Dennis Quaid, the star of Far From Heaven, The Rookie, In Good Company, and the new film Yours, Mine, and Ours. Join us for the next Fresh Air.